Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. We have a lot to share today, beginning with what is called guanabana. Ever heard of it? It's exciting. Can save lives. I'll tell you about it. Five ways that tea can improve your health. Asthma medication linked to growth suppression in children. What are the healing benefits of pumpkins? And a lot more on health and healing. From our public health segment, an in-depth discussion from Dr. Kelly Brogan from GreenMed Info on the perils of peeking into the womb, ultrasound risks. We were told there were no risks. Oh, yes, there are, and we'll explain them. Also today from our commentary and issue segments, genetically tweeted chickens suffer from a lack of fertility. Is this the end of commercial poultry? Brian Shohavy from Health Pack Impact News. A leak at Fukushima nuclear plant threatens a dangerous meltdown. Wasn't in the mainstream media. Well, we'll tell you about it. And a commentary today from Dar Jamal, from Tom Dispatch, A Nation on the Brink, How America's Policies Sealed Iraq's Fate. I'll be giving my own commentary within that. And if time permits, we'll be taking calls in our feedback segment. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. Somewhere on my website, there's a photograph of a couple photographs. One of Sam Skinner, who's one of America's great senior athletes. And he and I are holding, you know, like a hi-fi. We had just finished the Jamaica Marathon. And if you look carefully, you see that both of us have white streaks all over our legs. That's from the salt, because there was no water to drink during the marathon. It was the most difficult marathon I'd ever done, but we both won gold medals. We both were first in our groups, and I was pleased about that. But what really was interesting for me was the day before, there was this woman walking around the hotel area where we were staying with our running club. And she had this gigantic basket of fruit on her head. It looked like Carmen Miranda. And I asked her, I said, well, what all you got there? And it was all very inexpensive. And she handed me this particular fruit I'd never seen before. And this is the guanabana. Guana, G-U-A-N-A, bana, B-A-N-A. And it comes from other names. It's also called cherimoya or soursop, or custard apple, or Brazilian pawpaw, or graviola. It's the same fruit. It's a delectable, delicious, almost vanilla custard tasting. And it has a little seeds in it, spits seeds out. And I ate so many of those that day. I didn't have to do the carbo party that night because I had stuffed myself. I had all this different exotic fruit. And someone took a picture of me. I had this stuff all over my face. I'm lucky I got any of it in my mouth. But if you ever have a chance and you live in a temperate climate, grow cherimoya. Chera, C-H-E-R-I, moa, M-O-Y-A. Cherimoya is delicious. Soursop, same thing. It's grown all over the tropics, but rarely is it exported to the United States. Here's why it's important. There's some really important research showing how it impacts cancer, herpes, parasites, infections. It is a very important, natural, inexpensive, and effective treatment for cancer, according to Natural News. It, quote, extracts in the plant attack cancer safely and effectively with all natural therapy, does not cause extreme nausea, weight loss, or hair loss. It protects the immune system. It boosts energy and outlook on life. It effectively targets and kills malignant cells in 12 types of cancer, including colon, breast, prostate, lung, and pancreas. It provides up to 10,000 times stronger in slowing the growth of cancer cells than adriamycin, a commonly used chemotherapy drug. It selectively kills only cancer cells, unlike traditional chemotherapy treatments. As far back as the 1970s, the National Cancer Institute investigated the merits of the soursop and discovered the stems and leaves of the tree were successful in destroying cancer cells. Then they stopped doing research on it, even though it was, in 1976, it was proven to be an immensely potent cancer killer in 20 independent laboratory studies. But as of now, no double-blind clinical trials. Moreover, this study found that a compound derived from the leaves of the plant was, quote, selectively cytotoxic for the lung A549:HT29 and pancreas PACA2 cell lines with potencies equal or exceeding those of adriamycin, end quote. The researchers in the Journal of Natural Products discovered that extracts of the plant also are pesticidal, antimalarial, antiviral, antimicrobial. And likewise, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center states that the guanabana shows anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer effects in vitro and vivo. And so it's the leaves that they make a tea from down there, and either dried or fresh. And they use it. And I have put this on the protocol for the people with full-blown AIDS as just one of the items, but it makes a lot of difference. So if your leaves are that powerful, then the fruit is also going to be powerful. Now, I'm not aware of any studies on the fruit and cancer, but it's just like the olive. Olive leaf, olives, olive oil. Strawberry leaf, strawberries, strawberry juice. So you have to look at the whole plant. But for those in this audience who have family members who live in the tropics and you grow soursop, very easy to grow, grows very quickly. I grow it in my home in Florida. It might take for the first, well, if you're in a tropical area, you'll get it quickly. If you're not in a real tropical area, it might take a year and a half to 2 years. But once it starts coming, if you have bees and you have really good pollination, you could get a bumper crop and you could get a couple crops a year. By the way, just because of bees, having healthy bees where there's no sprays, no pesticides, I'm able to get cherries 3 times a year, figs 2x a year, and that's really unusual. You don't get cherries 3 times a year in Michigan or in Washington State or Oregon. That's the benefit of pollination, being able to grow 12 months a year. So one more thing that can help us on all levels. Now, teas are very important. And this time of year, you want a nice iced tea. And you can put a fresh mint in it. In fact, what I do is I'll take a whole bunch of fresh mint. Easy to grow fresh mint. You can grow it on your windowsill, your backyard. And then once you get it, you can dry it and put it in a jar, one of those old mason jars with a rubber lip and so it stays airtight. And there are jars now that you can draw the air out. There's like a little plunger, and as you push it down and then pull it out, the air is brought out with it, so it doubles the length of time something can stay fresh. Or you can take it fresh. Now, if you have fresh leaves of mint, and you can buy these in any store, you put those into a blender, blend them up, and then make a reduction in a little tincture bottle. That way, when you have your tea, iced tea, put 2 drops of that, and then put 2 drops of stevia, and it'll sweeten it. It's no calories whatsoever. It's a natural sweetener, and it also does healing work. So you get this wonderful, sweet, but very exotic, aromatic iced tea. And you can change flavors. And so, anyhow, have your tea each day. And here's why. First, because there's more than 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on how teas, mainly green teas, can help us with cleansing the liver, preventing breast cancer, colon cancer. And the reason why is because the National Cancer Institute has found that the polyphenols, that's a group of plant chemicals that includes the catechins, and catechins are what really make the tea powerful. So the higher the level of catechins, the higher the level of polyphenols, the healthier it is. It can reduce cardiovascular risk. It can reduce blood pressure. It helps with weight control. It's antibacterial. It provides protection against ultraviolet radiation and improves the quality of your skin. All good for you. Also, it helps maintain less stress because it can impact stress hormones in the body. It can calm the nerves, especially ashwagandha. Ash, A-S-H, WAG, W-A-G, A-N-D-H-A, ashwagandha. It helps calm nerves. I suggest ashwagandha for people who are a little stressed, who have trouble sleeping, who are antsy and have a hard time focusing. And ashwagandha protects against gastric ulcers. It has anti-tumor effects in animal studies. It improved memory in the elderly. So it's good all the way around. Also, Siberian ginseng tea reduces stress and anxiety. The University of Maryland Medical Center did studies on Eleuthero, which is the number one type of ginseng from Russia. It's an adaptogen, meaning it will help the body adapt to multiple stressors and mental fatigue, physical stress. Teas also help with digestion. Ginger and anise will be at the top of the list. Now, ginger tea, I just believe you should just get not hot, not boiling water ever, but just hot water, and shave ginger, put it into a little tea canister, and let it sit for about 10 minutes in hot water. Then put at the same time about a quarter of a teaspoon of anise seed, tiny little black seeds. Put them in there. And between the anise, which has a licorice taste, and the ginger, you can reduce gas, bloating, upset stomach, queasy stomach, and nausea. Inflammation in your digestive tract is really good for pregnant women. It helps if you've had chemotherapy and you're nauseous from the chemotherapy. And if you add also some chamomile, lemon balm, and peppermint, that can also add additional benefit for people with irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease, ileitis, colitis. But teas also help you with mental clarity, especially Gotu Kola. Gotu, G-O-T-U, Kola, K-O-L-A. It is probably the number one herb used in the world. And it's really important for the people in India, Japan, China, Indonesia, South Africa, Sri Lanka, South Pacific. It's famous for its healing qualities. It's used in a lot of places because it helps to remove or lessen varicose veins and varicosities, venous insufficiency, dementia, and skin lesions. It also improves brain function. So whatever kind of tea you're going to have, just make sure you're having some tea. It's important for you on a daily basis. And finally, asthma medications linked to growth suppression in children. This is from the Federal University of Rio Grande in Brazil. Two studies linking inhaled corticosteroids, those are the drugs found in inhalers given to people with asthma, have found that the drugs appear to impede the growth rate of children, and those should be of great concern to parents and physicians. Now, asthma is a chronic lung condition that occurs widely in the United States. I believe that its primary reason we have is because the overuse of vaccinations and the input of animal dairy products, milk, and gluten products, wheat and sugar. You get rid of those, you'll frequently find asthma clears up. But anyhow, if you're using these, you're going to end up stunting the growth of your child. And why take pumpkin? Well, because pumpkin has a lot of healing properties, and it's not just for the fall, not just for around Halloween. It is, quote, pumpkin is extremely nutrient dense, filled with vitamins and minerals, low in calories. And the USDA's National Nutrient Database shows that it has protein, low calories, quality fiber, and vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, and it has beta-carotene, and that's what gives it its orange flavor. And that's, but it's also known to lower your blood pressure. It's rich in potassium, and it's very good for you. So I would definitely have some pumpkin more often in the diet. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. We will go now to our environmental segment, because we brought a report to you just last week on an update from Professor Harvey Wasserman on the dangers at Fukushima, how there's an epidemic of cancer of the thyroid and precancer of the thyroid in the children living around that area of Japan. This is the latest. Quote, leak at Fukushima nuclear power plant threatens dangerous meltdown. Trouble is looming at Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant as a leak has forced the shutdown of a cooling system that could cause temperatures to exceed dangerous levels. Fukushima operator Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, was forced to switch off the cooling system at Reactor 5 unit after engineers discovered it had been leaking water. If the system is not repaired within the next 9 days, temperatures are expected to soar. And more than 340 gallons of water leak from the cooling system intended to stabilize the temperature of the spent fuel reactor at number 5. So, and this is at the same week that they're saying that they're going to bring two nuclear power plants back online. Now, they've been able to do fine meeting all their electric needs without any nuclear. So this has nothing to do with restarting their 50 nuclear power plants based upon need. This has to do with profit and politics. We have a lot of people listening to this program in Japan. In fact, right now we have people in 166 different countries listening all over the world, and plus on land-based stations and all over the United States. And by telephone, number one out of 4,000 different radio stations, people listen on the telephone. Here's the message. There's going to be two realities. The first reality is official, and that's where most people have trusted their information, and that's where most people have formed their opinions and perceptions, hence their reality. Now you have a alternative reality, where you look at the facts, they don't make sense, they don't add up. There's a disconnect. And you continue to probe. Others are not, you are. You're the doctor, you're the chemotherapist, you're the oncologist who says, why is it that I keep using the same protocols that I'm told to use by my peers based on consensus, and yet my patients are dying? And yet I heard about such and such using a different protocol, and the patients are living. So you explore that. And lo and behold, you try it, and you find out now your patients are surviving. So you have two realities simultaneously. You have the official story, and you have your own personal truth. Now you have to reconcile, which do you trust? Where you're conditioned to a trust authority, not yourself. That's why we are always, at every level of life, we're giving our power to make critical decisions to others. Then you look further and you see what you is. There are other therapies, not just the one I'm using, that are saving lives. And then that allows you to begin to understand that the system itself is flawed, but it's not willing to change, possibly can't change. There are too many people invested in it. When you have too many people making too much money and there's too much power to be lost, then I can promise you there's not going to be either reform or change. You may have been embarrassed. A whistleblower can embarrass someone, but that doesn't mean it changes anything. If we were to all change, what's wrong when that wrong has been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, then we would be a different nation. We would be a different people. We would be individually different. We'd be honoring our authentic selves. We don't. Now, multiply that times 1,000 or 2,000 because of all the different things we have been associated with, aligned with, believed in our lives. The official news, do we trust what's on Fox? It's fair and balanced. Well, he wants now to buy Time Warner. Well, that makes it a monopoly. Well, he already is completely unfair and unbalanced and completely prejudiced in his neoliberal view of the world. Now, he has a right to that view, but he wants us all to have that same view. So he hires people who have dynamic personalities, and they then proclaim there's only one truth, their truth, Bill O'Reilly's truth, or Sean Hannity's truth, whoever it may be. And the left does the same thing. You have as many 1% elitists on the left as you have on the right. But the left never acknowledges that. The hypocrisy is palpable. So then you wake up not knowing what to believe, who to believe, and that's a good place to be. In fact, the best thing you can ever do in your life when it comes to reason and thinking is to believe in nothing. No one. Start fresh and say, as of right now, I'm going to find what the truth is, and please don't tell me what it is. Let me find it for myself. Now, then you may find that it comes in part, not in whole, from someone else, in which case you take what you can and leave the rest be. But you don't have to morph into the person or their politics or their religion or something else because you found some truth that you can use within yours. And then one day, you're making really good decisions because you're not giving the sanctity of your critical thought process to those who are only going to abuse it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Share the information that you get and let people challenge it. Don't ask them to accept it. Challenge it. But if they find after challenging it there's something within it that makes sense to them, then at least they have some additional empowerment. In a moment, a commentary by myself and Dar Jamal. But I just was told that we have our social media researcher in studio, Aubrey. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi, Gary.
What do you have for us today, Aubrey?
I just wanted to come by and chat.
Can you turn your audio up? Ask the engineer to put it up, push it up.
Sure. Is that better?
Please.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just wanted to extend on a conversation that we had today discussing that it's just common knowledge these days that there are paid government shills kind of trolling the internet and stunting the conversation that progressives are having in seeking the truth. And that prompted me to go and look into the people that are seeking out our documentaries, including Death by Medicine, War on Health, Seeds of Death, and Knocking on the Devil's Door. And it turns out that there are about 75 million search results that turn up for that, as opposed to a total 2 million for some of the other top documentaries, including Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, The 11th Hour, and a few more. So I just thought that was really interesting information that I should share with you, and that we're really excited and proud that PRN can serve as a forum for these people to come together and seek the truth, and that these documentaries are just so socially relevant.
Well, here's the larger picture. The larger picture is that the pharmaceutical companies and their vaccine affiliates in particular have started a national campaign, worldwide campaign, to target any parent, any group that have had damage to their children because of vaccines to discredit the parents and to bring forth a group of selected physicians. And by the way, next week we'll be reporting on this. Richard Gelnau will be sharing with you the names of those physicians who have allowed themselves to be the attack dogs for the pharmaceutical pro-vaccine group. They will have former people from the National Institutes of Health. In other words, they're going to have people with pedigrees going forward saying vaccines are safe and effective. Anyone suggesting otherwise is just a quack. They have, you know, they're endangering the lives of people. And they will have a massive campaign. They're already infiltrating talk sessions in the different autism websites, vaccine awareness websites. They're doing it also with animal rights groups, environmental groups, global warming groups. So everywhere that you have anyone speaking out against injustice, lies, corruption, corporatization, you'll have a pushback now of people who are in the system. For example, one person we found thus far, and this is because of a lawsuit we're bringing in discovery, because that's where you nail a person, is working out of his mother's basement. And I won't mention now because this is going to get some real important news in the very near future. But this person has been paid by a major scientist to attack anyone who's his critics and to try to demean them, lie, slander them, libel them. So on the one hand, oh, it's more than just Fox. Fox, of course, is just a forum for fascists. And look at all the people they have on there who have been discredited, who have terrible reputations, who've been wrong, historically wrong, on everything they've said, which has caused suffering. And if these are the people who are allowed to come back on and mouth something as if they're accurate, they're not. MSNBC is no better. And CNN is just a pathetic excuse for anything. I mean, the whole media is just so compromised. So only when you see how compromised it is, how would you know it's compromised unless you go to a place it's not? How would you know what the truth is until, if you've been engaged in accepting half-truths for so long? There's an old Jewish statement, half-truth is a full lie. So the only way we have right now to push back and continue to share the truth is to share information, share resources. If you read an article that's important to you and you find meaning in it, share it with other people. If you see a documentary or film of some kind and it empowered you, it frightened you, it angered you, share it with other people. If you have a book or if you heard a broadcast, let people know about it. Because that right now, at least at this moment, they're trying. They haven't been able to stop. But if they could, they would. There'd be no internet with activists if they had their way. But up to this point, now you just mentioned some films. You mentioned some good films. In fact, those have been the most popular documentaries. There's the March of the Penguins, but the most popular documentaries in history were, you know, An Inconvenient Truth, Bowling for Columbine, Sicko, Fahrenheit 9/11, DiCaprio's documentary on The 11th Hour. All good, all served a purpose. But those were in movie theaters. It was also about the money. Let us not forget that a lot of those people are also in the liberal 1% elite, right? You won't find them voting for Jill Stein or Ralph Nader. In fact, they'll demean Ralph Nader. They'll sucker punch him in half, which is, you know, that's a whole part of that sick and twisted concept of not being able to define what a person is by what they do, but rather define a person by what they want you to define them as instead of what they've done. And if I see someone who's acting like a jerk, saying things that are wrong, supporting the wrong sides of issues, it doesn't matter what he tells me. I'm looking at what he's done. I'm going to judge him by what he's done. In any case, but beside that, they have been very successful, and these films have been open minds and inspired people to think. But on the internet, it's how many searches results do you have for their documentaries collectively total?
Just a little over 2 million.
Okay, and how many search results do you have for our documentaries?
Over 75 million.
75 million, and that's just today.
Yep.
That's just today. So that's why people are now looking for resources to empower movements in other areas. And I'm glad about that. What we need is we need more people doing documentaries, more people writing articles, more people coming forth and whistleblowing. We need more people willing to share insights that can help people and solve problems, solutions. That's what we need. And the more we get, the more we will share. And we're sharing a lot of that every day. I think we have about 60 different articles every single day and on these topics, different every day. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yep, thank you.
I think it's relevant because most people don't realize when you see a lot of negative reviews and attack criticisms. For example, just not long ago, there were 125 different attacks, all in the same language, clearly written by the same person on just one site. So they're at work out there. Just be aware of that. Provocateurs, interlopers, they're using the internet to attack those. And there are many people doing good work. I'm Gary Knoll. Your opportunity to speak in a moment, but first we want to go over and say hello to our guest standing by, Jim Turner. He's a newsmaker today. We're going to talk about the aggressive assault against natural supplements and who is behind it and why. Jim Turner is one of the original Nader Raiders and a principal in the Washington law firm of Swanken and Turner, where he represents consumer interests concerning food, drugs, health, and environmental products, etc. He is the board chair of the Citizens for Health and the author of Voice of the People, the Transpartisan Imperative in American Life. And his website is VOP.org and Swanken-Turner.com. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Jim, for a long time now, we've been fighting a war against federal health agencies to finally have the scientific evidence supporting health benefits of foods and vitamins and supplements recognized. And the scientific literature is thorough and complete on the safety and efficacy of natural products that even have medical properties for given diseases and medical conditions. Yet the federal government and their pharmaceutical allies continue to deny this science. And even more recently, we're witnessing an aggressive assault against natural products and therapies. Dr. Paul Offit is only their celebrity spokesperson. However, the assault on supplements goes much deeper. Earlier this year, Reuters reported that a third of Americans from a study believe that the government is trying to suppress access to natural cures. Yet the Journal of the American Medical Association, when reporting on the study, called this group of Americans kooks and conspiracy theorists. Anyone who challenges the official word is now described as a conspiratorialist. And of course, there is no reference to the thousands of people who die every year from conventional medicine and prescription drugs that provide a rationale to question the government's true motives and corporate alliances. So the FDA increasingly is now making outrageous claims that many supplements have no benefits, and very recently even carotenoid pigments in fruits and vegetables that are converted to vitamin A, they challenge. So I'd like to hear your observations on your investigations into why we are currently witnessing the increase in assaults on alternative and natural medicine. And in your opinion, what is the ultimate goal of the federal government? Form is yours.
Well, I think that the Federal Trade Commission, in issuing a press release just in the last couple of days, really kind of bared the cover on that question. They noted that after the economic downturn, the dietary supplement industry actually had an upturn in sales. And in their press release, they said they therefore needed to increase their vigilance because people who were finding that they did not have enough money to use mainstream medicine were now turning to dietary supplements for their health and were trying to take over control of their health and not be continuing to patronize their physicians and the medical system. I mean, this is in a press release from the Federal Trade Commission. I suspect that the bureaucratic operatives that put that release out and the people who believe that the point they're making is a sound one don't realize what a awful story is revealed there. Here we have people taking responsibility for their lives. There was just an attack on dietary supplements for about an hour on the Diane Rehm show yesterday. Just one after another, even people who are in the dietary supplement industry taking up the cudgel against the industry, they were talking about 70% of the public using dietary supplements. You have the FTC arguing that dietary supplement sales are going up. You have a situation where people are systematically saying, I want to take care of my own health. And now the government carrying out a message that the pharmaceutical industry really likes people to hear goes forward and says we have to protect these people from their own ignorance. And you're hearing this more and more as the public is getting more and more engaged, more and more intelligent, more and more knowledgeable, more and more information. The systems of the society, the corporate systems and the government systems are being drawn into play to try to undercut the rights of the individual to use those kinds of opportunities. It's interesting that you mentioned the AMA's reference to people who believe that that as we do, that we're kooks and crazy people. That's exactly what the FDA said to me when I was doing the chemical feast back in 1968. There were 55,000 comments against the FDA's effort to restrict dietary supplements then, and the FDA official I was interviewing said that they were all kooks. It's a very interesting underlying problem, and I think it's a fundamental problem. Anything that is natural, that is based on people's own experience, that's based on their own knowledge and insight, is viewed with suspicion by people in the marketplace and by people who are regulators of the marketplace. And it's a big, huge battle across the board.
Jim, I have one final question for you, and I appreciate your insights there. You nailed it. On the one hand, there is a very simple reason why people believe in conspiracies, because conspiracies occur. For example, just in the last 10 days, there has been Citigroup, which had to settle a $7 billion lawsuit. They engaged in a conspiracy. Then we had Wells Fargo settling a $900 million lawsuit because they engaged in a conspiracy. We have had tens of thousands of known conspiracies, insider trading, price fixing. In China right now, GlaxoSmithKline officials are being arrested because they conspired to, in effect, use the medical community and apply them with gifts and everything to get them to use their drugs. Every day we're uncovering and publishing about these conspiracies. And yet, for somehow, the people from Rachel Maddow and Keith Urban, all these other people, they've never seen a conspiracy, evidently. And I don't know how you reach these people. I don't believe they're reachable. I believe that people realize what kind of world we live in, how manipulative the government is. Look, did I miss something, or didn't Snowden and Julian Assange show us that the entire federal complex is nothing but one giant conspiracy? People working in secret together against the interests of the public, that is a conspiracy. It defines a conspiracy. The fact that they want to attack the person exposing it instead of looking at the reality of the crimes and misdemeanors that were exposed shows you how hard they're trying to keep the public living as if they're infantile-minded. Your final thoughts?
Well, I think that there is a whole class of people who are speakers in our society who are essentially brain dead when it comes to what's actually going on. You mentioned Paul Offit. I went to hear Paul Offit speak here in Washington. I was shocked at his ignorance. I mean, his position is that acupuncture stems from something about 12 rivers in China. Now, I've worked with the acupuncture community for 20 years, and I've never even heard the 12 rivers in China idea, let alone as the font of acupuncture. And he made one statement after another that was just completely wrong. I think he's, I just don't think he thinks clearly. I think that's true. I like much of what Rachel Maddow says, and at the same time, I look at some of the things that she does, and I say to myself, why isn't she getting the information that should be a part of the stories that she's putting out? And the only thing I can come up with, which I see in members of Congress and I see in bureaucrats here in Washington, is they're brain dead. They're mind dead on really important things that are going on in the lives of individual people across the country. And it's a fundamental problem that needs a lot of attention, and a lot of people are working hard on it. And we just need to keep pushing back and understanding that the argument for a natural approach to living has got real vitality and vibrant force that is actually shaking the foundations of the system that we're used to being managed by. the whole internet, the demographics, the dynamics that are underway are changing the power structure, and they're fighting back to hang on to what they've had all up until now.
I agree with that. And also, I believe Dick Durbin is just about as ignorant as you can be on the subject, and he's sponsoring a bill, the Dick Durbin's Dietary Supplement Labeling Act, that would remove countless supplements from the market and make them prohibitively expensive. And then you look at who funds their campaigns. Boy, all you have to do is follow the money in all of Washington. I just think Washington, D.C. is just one giant septic tank that is overflowing. Thank you very much, Jim, for all the good work you are doing and have done, going clear back to the mid-1960s, one of the original Nader Raiders with Ralph Nader and Michael Jacobson and Sidney Wolfe. All the best to you. I want to do some public health discussion now and some issues that are important for all of us. The first is from the Vaccine Liberation Army, and it's entitled 131 Ways an Infant Can Die. And then it gives this specific story. Quote, "My name is Donna Gray. I'm a constituent of Senator Kennedy's from Massachusetts. Our family should have celebrated our very first granddaughter's first birthday last month. Instead, we'll be commemorating the anniversary of her death at the end of this month. Our granddaughter, Leanne, was just 8 weeks old when her mother took her to the doctor for her routine checkup. That includes, of course, her first DPT inoculation and oral polio vaccine. In all, her entire 8 weeks of life is lovable, extremely alert as a baby, never producing any blood-curdling screams as she did at the moment the shot was given. Neither had her mother ever before seen her back arch as it did while she was screaming. She was inconsolable. Even her daddy could not understand Leanne's uncharacteristic screaming and crying. 4 hours later, Leanne was dead. Crib death, the doctor said. Sudden infant death syndrome. Could it be connected to the shot, her parents implored? No. But she just had her first DPT shot this afternoon. Could there possibly be any connection to it? No. No connection at all, the emergency room doctor said defiantly. My husband and I hurried to the hospital the following morning after Leanne's death to talk with the pathologist before the autopsy. We wanted to make sure he was alerted to her DDP inoculation such a short time before her death, just in case there was something else that he could look at for to make the connection. He was unavailable to talk with us. We waited 2.5 hours. Finally, we got to talk to another doctor after the autopsy had been completed. He said it was sudden infant death syndrome. In the months before Leanne was born, I regularly checked with a friend as the state of her grandchild's condition. He is nearly a year and a half older than Leanne. On his first DPT shot, he passed out cold for 15 minutes, right in the pediatrician's office. Quote, normal reaction for some kids, the pediatrician assured. The parents were scared, but they knew what a fine doctor they had. They trusted his judgment. When it was time for the second shot, they asked, are you sure it's all right? Is it really necessary? Their pediatrician again reassured them. He told them how awful it was to experience, as he had one of his infant patients bout with whooping cough. That baby had died. They gave him his second DPT shot that day. He became brain damaged. This past week, I had an opportunity to read through printed copies of the hearings of this committee. I'm dismayed to learn that this same talk has been going on for years, and nothing has seemed to progress to incorporate what seems so obvious necessary to keep from destroying any more babies and to compensate financially those who have already been damaged for life. How accurate are our statistics on adverse reactions to vaccines when parents have been told and are still being told there's no connection to the shot, no connection at all? What about the mother I have recently talked with who has a 4-year-old brain-damaged son? On all three of his DPT shots, he had convulsion in the presence of the pediatrician. No connection, the pediatrician assured. I talked with a father in a town adjoining ours whose son died at the age of 9 weeks, several months before our own granddaughter's death. It was the day after his DPT inoculation. Sudden infant death syndrome is the statement on the death certificate. Are the statistics that the medical world loves to quote to say, quote, there is no connection, really accurate? Or are they based upon poor diagnosis, poor record keeping? What is being done to provide a safer vaccine? Who's overseeing it? Will it be the same scientists and doctors who have been overseeing the past? How much longer does the public have to wait? How are physicians and clinics going to be held accountable to see that parents are informed of these possible reactions? And how are those children who should not receive any vaccination being identified before they're damaged or dead? End quote. And that was by Neil Miller. This is a most excellent article. I'm posting it on our website, blog.garynull.com. And here's what Neil Miller writes, quote, when the coroners arrive, quote, cause of death by choosing from an established code list. A closer inspection of this code list is 130 official ways for an infant to die. But medical certifiers, such as coroners, could choose from among several categories of death when a baby suddenly expired. They didn't have to list the death as sudden infant death syndrome. Although the post-neonatal sudden infant death syndrome rate dropped by an average of 8.6% from 1992 to 2001, following the AAP's seemingly successful back-to-sleep campaign, the post-neonatal mortality rate for suffocation in bed increased during the same period of time, up to an average of 11.2%. Sudden, unexplained infant deaths that were classified as sudden infant death syndrome prior to the back-to-sleep campaign were now being classified as deaths due to suffocation in bed. But where is sudden infant death syndrome and vaccines? There are none. So they've rejected the idea that vaccines could be one of the 130 causes of death. So it goes. Separately, I just thought this was a bit interesting. This is how have these corporations colonized our public life by George Monteviot. How do you engineer a bland, depoliticized world, a consensus built around consumption and endless growth, a dream world of materialism and debt in which all relations can be prefixed with a dollar sign? In which we cease to fight for change. We delegate our powers to companies whose profits depend upon this model. Power shifting to places in which we have no voice, no vote. Domestic policies are forged by special advisors and spin doctors, by panels and advisory committees stuffed with lobbyists. The self-hating state withdraws its own authority to regulate and direct. Simultaneously, the democratic vacuum at the heart of global governance is being filled without anything resembling consent by international bureaucrats and corporate executives. The NGOs permitted, often as an afterthought, represent neither civil society nor the electorates. And please spare me that guff about consumer democracy or shareholder democracy. In both cases, some people have more votes than others, and those with the most votes are the least inclined to press for change. To me, the giant consumer goods company Unilever symbolizes these shifting relationships. I can think of no entity that has done more to blur the lines between the role of the private sector and the role of the public sector. If you blotted out its name while reading its web pages, you could mistake it for an agency of the United Nations. It seems to have representation almost everywhere. Its people inhabit the British government's Ecosystem Markets Task Force, the Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition, the International Fund for Agricultural Development, the G8's New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, the World Food Program, the Global Green Growth Forum, the UN's Scaling Up Nutrition Program, its Sustainable Development Solutions Network, Global Impact, and the UN High-Level Panel on Global Development. Sometimes Unilever uses this power well in efforts to reduce its own energy and water and its production of waste and to project these changes beyond its own walls. Its Dove's Self-Esteem Project, for instance, claims to be helping millions of young people to improve their self-esteem through educational programs. One of its educational videos maintains that beauty, quote, couldn't be more critical to your happiness, which is surely the belief that trashes young people's self-esteem in the first place. But of course, you can recover if you plastering yourself with Dove-branded goop. Unilever reports that 82% of women in Canada who are aware of this project, quote, would be more likely to purchase Dove soap. Sometimes it seems to play both ends of the game. For instance, it says it's reducing the amount of salt and fat and sugar in its processed foods, but it also hosted and chaired before the last election the Conservative Party's Public Health Commission, which was seen by both health campaigners as an excuse for avoiding effective action on obesity, poor diets, and alcohol abuse. This body helped to purge government policy of such threats as further advertising restrictions and compulsory traffic light labeling of sugar, salt, and fat. The commission then produced a responsibility deal between government and business on the organizing board of which Unilever still sits. Under this deal, the usual relationship between lobbyists and government is reversed. The corporations draft government policy, which is then sent to civil servants for comment. Regulation is replaced by voluntarism. The Guardian has named Unilever as one of the companies that refused to sign the deal's voluntary pledge on calorie restriction. And so it goes. Everywhere you look, someone in corporate America has figured out how to game the system so they have control over what we eat, what we think, where we live, how we live, what we vote on our policies. This is just one example how they've corporatized everything. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, I have a bunch of emails here. One thing that I found very disturbing was on the front page of the New York Times the day before yesterday. I've had a lot of people in the audience email me about this, and one person actually left the article on my desk. And it says that malnutrition in well-fed children is linked to poor sanitation in India. Now, everyone has said, Gary's been talking about this for years, and now all of a sudden it's on the front page of the New York Times. And it says there's an emerging body of scientific studies that suggest that the 162 million children under the age of five in the world are malnourished because of lack of sanitation, not necessarily because of lack of food. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that a huge population, especially in India, and you've been talking about this forever, they're defecating outdoors. And when the child is exposed to things like this, lack of sanitation during the first 2 years of life, the children become stunted. And what's particularly disturbing is that the fact that they lose height and they lose intelligence, and that's permanent. So
let me address this. First, we keep hearing about exceptionalism. I'm going to do a commentary on that tomorrow. But what we don't look at is what's exceptional when you end up having an entire population put at risk because you do not look at what is important in the commons, meaning how could a public health policy benefit everyone? And that would be true of India. Now, on the one hand, India is the largest democracy in the world, but it's also the most flawed democracy in the world, because it's utterly corrupt at every level. And what it does, it allows those people who are most powerful, the oligarchs in their country, to control political blocks, and those political blocks then control the judiciary and control local. It's almost like a fiefdom. If you look at a person who's wealthy in Pakistan and in India, mind you, they were both the same country at one point, till Pakistan was partitioned, mainly for the Muslims, you would have a person being a governor, meaning everything in that community went to them. They were the ones who gave patronage. They were the ones who saw that you could open a business, providing that you gave them some of it. You could farm, providing that you gave them money or crop. Every single thing done by every single person in there came back to them. And that's how India is run today. The wealthiest control everything. Now, the wealthy have to have industries or services that that will support them. So then they end up having their own graduates, highly educated people work for them and that causes an increase in their income. So you have about 250 million people in India who are living what we would consider an upper-middle-class existence. Almost all of those people are living in very exclusive and very expensive gated communities. And even though they're right in the middle of the rest of the population, you would have thought that they were completely a different reality. They have green grass. They have water they can drink because it comes from the wells that they dig right there that are not available to the millions of poor who live in the same immediate area. They can flush a toilet. They don't have to worry about that. They have a sink to wash their hands. They have a bidet they can use to clean their rear end. They have all the food they want. They have everything done for them because labor is dirt cheap. And yet when they look out their window, they're looking out over slums, which is one of the ironies of India. You know, could you imagine if you're in the Ritz-Carlton, if you're in some of the hotels in New York, at the Sherry Netherland, the Plaza, you're looking out over Central Park. Now imagine if Central Park was a giant, steaming, completely polluted ghetto. That is India. And so when the people go to drink, they don't have clean water. When they go to defecate, they go wherever they can. And it's massive. Just imagine about 1.5 to 2 billion defecations per day in just one of the cities. And that gives you some idea. Now, do they put their money into a sewer system, a water purification system, an electrical grid system, a sanitation system with septic systems? No. So whatever was there, frequently some of that goes clear back to colonial times. And those are broken. They never work. So massive amounts of pollution occur. The people have no choice but to wash their clothes in septic water, to bathe in septic water, and to drink septic water. As a result, even if they have enough food to eat, they end up with amoebic dysentery, they end up with schistosomiasis, they end up with parasitic infections, and they end up with diarrhea, frequently dying. The infant mortality death is extremely high. But you'll notice around India, you'll see a lot of people who have these pot bellies, yet they're skinny all over. That is because of the parasites harboring from the food and from the lack of sanitation. The poor people of India deserve better. The rich people of India don't care. The government doesn't care and sides with the rich. That is why it's the most corrupt, the largest democracy in the world. And I will continue to say this, irrespective of those who've been to an ashram in India, had a good time, learned to kiss the feet of the Buddha, and came home and wanted to be an aspiring person in their field. Then there's the reality of what it is to live every day as the average person in India. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program.